Accession number 32380, reel 2.
Eating or drinking, anything. I just couldn't face myself going and fighting for them. You know, blood across, it was horrendous. And then, after a few days, the disease started to spread out all the place. It was a huge, horrible smell. And all the aid workers and the police and everything, they had masks because it was just horrendous. They decided to, because there was no sanitary, there was no, it was horrendous. And they decided to let people go out. And the only way that Macedonians would allow people to, you know, leave the camp was that NATO troops who were based in Macedonia at the time, and they're still based there, they decided to build camps for people.
So the Macedonians just said it's not our problem?
Yeah, they said it's not our problem. We have our own political problems. We don't want Albanians in our country. Because, I mean, they were quite scared in a way. I don't just want to justify, you know, their actions, but there was a huge population of Albanians in Macedonia anyway. It's about 35% or 40% population is Albanians anyway, and then they were just probably afraid that it's going to destabilise the, you know, the population and demography and stuff like that. I just don't know. Or maybe they were just aligning with Serbia. I just don't know. I can just speculate here. Mm.
So when you got over the border, what happened then?
When we got over the border, we were put on the lorries, on the other buses, and we were sent straight away to, well, I can tell for myself. And, you know, people leaving the border, there was no particular order. It was just a massive crowd of people. They were just letting few people go out from the police, you know, barricade. And a lot of family, loads of family were separated then. And a lot of kids were left separated. And if one person managed to go, you know, beyond the police barricade, they had no chance to come back and get their family. Or they just didn't let the family go further and stuff. And my family got separated in three places, three parts. My brother went out with my auntie, because my auntie had a really bad attack. So they got a stretcher and they took her out. With one of my cousins, they took her out to give her the first aid, and then there was a bus. We put her on the bus, and my brother and the cousin, and they left for Macedonia. Then I was there with my parents and my other siblings. My dad, he just couldn't stand on the crowd, because 2 months prior to that, he had a heart attack, and he had a double bypass operation, so he just couldn't stand the crowd. So I said, no, I can't stay here, just whoever can, you know, manage, leave and go. So I went out with my three sisters and myself, and my mum, she obviously stayed with my dad, and my youngest brother decided to stay there. They said, we're just going to stay here, whatever happens, and whoever can, you know, it was a really hard decision, you know, to decide who's going to make, who's going to stay behind. So we went out, and then we were sent to a camp called Stankovic. They set up a camp, and we were sent there. And then after 2 weeks, we found out that, you know, the parents had left the place as well, and they were sent to a different camp. My brother managed to get out, because I had an uncle who had a family, and they rented a house in Macedonia. So he took my auntie and with my cousin to my uncle, and they were in the house in Macedonia. So we managed to find out, you know, where people were, but it was quite horrendous, to be honest with you. And the only closest thing that I can compare was with a 1930s film that we saw what happened in Germany with the Jews, you know, being asked to march across the town and go on the trains and sent to concentration camps and stuff. But, you know, Jews were all, you know, majority of them were killed and stuff like that. It was impossible. It was not.
I was going to ask you about this. Just about how you felt. I mean, going right back to when you were in Pristina and they were clearing out the streets. I mean, you had no idea what was happening to you.
No, we had no idea at all. And there were rumours. I mean, oh God, you know, fear is just the worst thing that could happen to you. We were so scared, to be honest with you. And there were rumours that they are avoiding boys and men, and they're sending them. They're dividing boys and men, and they're sending them to the city stadium, and they're going to execute them. So, you know, we had to walk across the town, you know, being, you know, thinking that we are walking to be executed. basically. So it was horrendous. And every 10 seconds there were shootings in the air, there were shootings in the crowd, and you know, just provocating and putting fear into people. And you know, everybody, it's horrible seeing, you know, hundreds of thousands of people's faces, you know, everybody so scared and so sad and stuff like that. It was horrendous.
And presumably because of what happened in Bosnia as well. I mean, even more exactly, recently, than the Second World War.
Yeah, exactly, because we saw what happened in Bosnia, we saw what happened in Croatia, and, you know, we know what happened during the Second World War and stuff like that. And I imagine loads of times the only difference from that, if you see both films, it's going to be that the Kosovo filming is going to be in colour, and Germany, the Second World War was black and white. It was just, it was horrendous, it was so bad. And then dividing families and kids in the border with Macedonia was pretty horrendous and stuff. But because the times were different, it was 21st century, really. It was the end of 20th century. Everybody had a mobile phone, and the majority of people were computer literate. So, I mean, that's how I found out where my family was, because we were on the phone. And what we did, we had a cousin who lived in Switzerland. Every member of family had that his number. And we said, whatever happened, any time you have a chance to get access to a phone, just phone him, tell him where you are.
So you made this plan in advance?
We made this plan in advance, and that's what we did. So we managed to get a phone. We phoned our, after 2 weeks, we phoned our cousin in Switzerland and said, oh yeah, I've been contacted by them, I've been contacted by them. This one's there, this one's there, that one's there. So this is what happened. And after we found out where everybody is, in the camp, my brother, he got a house. He rented a house in Macedonia. So he got to the camp and got my parents out from the camp into Macedonia. And then we went to the house, and then my dad came in the camp and to talk to us and see whether we want to go out as well. And I made a decision with my sisters not to leave the camp because we didn't have enough money, we didn't have enough jobs, and we didn't want to be burdened off anybody. There was a huge help from Albanians who lived in Macedonia, you know, providing food, providing shelter for people. And I just couldn't face being anybody's burden. I said, well, I'll stay here in the camp and whatever happened.
Was it well organised in there?
It was good organised well enough, you know, as much as they had. You know, we had a tent, we had a few blankets, and we had food, and that's all we needed. We had drinking water.
What did you feel about the future at that stage?
Well, I didn't think about the future, to be honest with you. I didn't think about the future. Well, one thing I knew, I said, well, I knew that anywhere I end up, because I knew that I'm not going to live in the camp, you know, forever. Wherever I end up, you know, I've got my health, I've got my skills, I was a joiner, and I'll be able to survive. But that's the only thing that was going through my mind. I had no plans, I had no future, because there was no future, to be honest with you. And then the camp started getting, you know, quite crowded, you know, from day to day. And I think it was designed for 10,000 people. But there were over 40,000 people in the camp. It was very crowded. And then the United Nations, they decided to evacuate people and get people... I'm talking lower and lower, so you won't pick up anything. They decided to evacuate people, you know, from the camps. And that's when, you know, humanitarian evacuation started happening. And you know, a week after we went to the camp, they marked every tent with a number. So they divided camp into different sections, A, B, C, D, F and stuff. And then they started marking, you know, giving numbers to the tent. And then they came and registered everybody who lived in the tent. And then on the back of the register, there were a list of the countries where people would want to go if they are to be evacuated. And I just did not want it to go anywhere. I registered my people and, you know, my sisters, and there were other people living in the same tent. It was 10 of us. So we decided not to go anywhere. We said, no, we don't want to go anywhere. We're just going to stay here and hopefully, you know, go home.
You still wanted to go home?
I still wanted to go home. And then after 4 weeks staying in the camp, you know, the life was just so unbearable. And they came against, because they were coming with a list after every
every other day. You know, they were saying, well, there's another country was put on the list, another country was put on the list. And then they came and they say to us, well, there's a few more countries put on the list, like Bulgaria wants to evacuate people, England wants to evacuate people, Canada wants to evacuate people, New Zealand wants to evacuate people, and the other countries that were already on the list. And they said, we just put three, you know, preferences. And
this was a totally random selection of countries?
Yeah. And they said, just put three, you know, preferences that you might wish to go and see how it goes. And I just said, well, okay, I'll put UK, Canada, and I think it was Israel or something like that. It's just, I don't care, just go somewhere. And then, luckily, you know, our name came up to come to England.
Did you speak any English at this stage?
I spoke a little bit. You know, my English was pretty poor, but I was getting by. And I was pretty, you know, capable of communicating, basically.
And what was your perception of England at that stage?
Well, I had no idea. I didn't know anything about England, to be honest with you. I knew very little about England. You know, what I've learned from school or saw the news, I knew that, you know, London was the capital, and that was it. And then when we got on the plane, we had a very short talk by a refugee council's representative. We heard about refugee council. And there was a representative there who came all the way to the camp and, you know, to accompany the evacuees. And he said, well, this plane, we're going to take you somewhere in the middle of the country called East Midlands. And we landed at East Midlands Airport, and we just had no idea what that is and what this means. And then I just remember the first sight of Britain, you know, from the plane. I saw a lot of fields. I think it was, I don't know, it could be Devon, Cornwall and stuff like that. They were full of this, what do you call this, oil seed?
Oil seed rape.
Yes.
Yellow stuff.
Loads of it. And we had no idea what that was. We just thought, wow, England must be doing really well with this kind of, because we didn't have that. And it was April, so where every field was so yellow, and it was just that was my first, you know, impression of, not impression, but my first, what's the word?
Perception
of England, you know.
And you had your sisters with you?
I had my sisters with me. I had, well, I mean, we reorganised our stuff when my dad came. Grandma said, no, I'm not going to go and be anybody's burden. My youngest sister, she went. She said, no, I'm coming up with you, no, just to be with parents and look after them. My brother was outside initially the first time around. He came and joined us. So I came over with two sisters and one brother. It's four of us who came over, and the other four stayed behind.
And how did you feel about leaving without four of them?
It was quite hard, but it was not as hard as when we left the first time around in the camp, because I knew that, you know, they're not going to die as such, they're going to be okay. And, you know, it was pretty hard, because, I mean, we never planned to leave, to be honest with you. I didn't have a passport or anything. I never planned to live abroad, and let alone, you know, come as far as England or Britain. But so it was not that hard, because we thought, well, we are just being evacuated, you know, temporarily. And we might go home at some point.
And were you aware that there was a lot of international attention on you, on the border region? And
no, we weren't, because we, for months, we had no a way of following any news or any communication or anything. We didn't know. I mean, whilst we were in the camp, we knew that, you know, it's quite a huge thing, because we had people coming and visiting the camp. We had, I mean, Bill Clinton came all the way from South America, where he was living. He came to the camp to visit, you know, just to see refugees. And we had a lot of famous people, you know, just doing their PR as they did. We had, what's his name? Oh, he's a famous actor. I forgot his name, to be honest. He played an officer and gentleman.
Richard Gere.
Yeah, he came to the camp. And a lot of famous people, honestly, came to the camp and doing their PR. So we knew that it's huge internationally, but we just didn't know how huge it was, because we had little transistors and radios and stuff, but that was basic. I mean, the only thing we wanted is just to keep alive.
And
and keep warm. It's just so bloody cold. It's really cold.
Shut the window.
Okay.
I think it's the lorry.
No, it's just...
It won't be long, will it?
No, it's just going out.
Okay, so you flew into East Midlands Airport.
We flew to East Midlands Airport, and the airport was closed for any other flight. So I was quite impressed. But then it's a very small airport, they can do that very easily. So we flew there, and at the airport there were loads of... it was quite well organised, you know, waiting for us. And there were... Immigration were there, which we had no idea what it was. And there were police, there were social services, there were loads of different, you know, charities, you know, waiting for that. There were volunteers who were trying to help. And when we went to the airport, then there were loads of, you know, desk tables full of food and water and stuff like that, you know, just to welcome us. And then we were just saying, you know, we went there, we had about 10 minutes, just went everybody together there, and they said, well, we have to go from this table to that table to that table, talk to immigration, you know, just sort out your identity and who you are and who you want to be with and all that. And we were given temporary status. At the time they used to call it exception leave to remain. Mm-hmm. So we were given that for a year from, I remember, 29th of April 1999 to 29th of April 2000. And because we were not explained in detail what that was, we thought that they're going to keep us in England for a year. And to a lot of people it was absolutely shocking. I remember my sister were crying because they thought that they're going to be away for a year. But then what happened was, after in July the very same year, when the war ended and all that, Britain and the rest of the world started, you know, organising voluntary return flights back, so people had a chance to go back. And that's what happened to my siblings, my brother and my sisters. They went back home straight away.
Through
their own choice, yeah. But they, but you know, when we were given the, you know, that exception leave to remain, and we just didn't know what that is, and it was not really clearly explained to us. But I don't really blame, because it was so emotional, it was so surreal, you know, the whole situation. And stuff. And so we were given that, and the whole group of people that we came on the plane, we were divided into two groups. We were given some, you know, I think pink papers and blue papers. And they made an announcement. They said, well, the pink papers, they will go out this way and get on the buses, and they're going to Derby. Whilst blue papers go on that exit, and you're going to Leicester. And okay, fine. I mean, we were just playing like sheep, you know, take us anywhere, doesn't matter. So from the airport, we were taken to, near Derby, there was a place called Streatham, a little village called Streatham, and they rented a house called Streatham House. It was quite a big, like a mansion, but pretty run down. And since it was sold and it was turned into flats, it was a good place, you know, away from the public, away from, you know, journalists or other things, so they just wanted to send us and, you know, give us some time to just to relax and get our thoughts together and all that. So we were sent there, and we lived in that place for about 4 months. And then because we had that, you know, exception leave to remain, we had, you know, work entitlements, we had benefits entitlements and all that. And then the organisation who was looking after us was Refugee Action, actually. So it was them who were looking after us, and they helped us to go and register with the job centre, as you do, and the benefits, and they liaised very closely, they worked really hard with the Derby City Council to provide council houses. So we moved gradually from that place into council houses, and whoever remained, basically, because my brother never did that, he went home straight away.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister stayed a little bit longer because they just wanted to learn English. So whilst we're here, this is the best place in the world if you want to learn English. So they stayed, they did a course for a year, and they went home.
Any interaction here with ordinary British people, or was it mainly with officials?
Well, there were a lot of volunteers who used to come to
to the reception centre where we used to stay in Stratton, and they used to come almost on a daily basis to befriend with us or just stay there, play with us, talk to us and stuff like that. Some people came just out of curiosity just to see whether we were black or white. Honestly, as simple as that. And some people came just to see how, you know, war victims looked like and stuff like that. You know, it was a curiosity interest. And some people came purely just from the goodness of their heart to help us. And I still keep in touch with some people. It's 8 years, 9 years now. I still keep in touch with them. And you know, we would send Christmas cards and emails, odd emails, once or twice a year, you know, just to keep in touch. And there were, you know, the reaction from the people was just so positive. But it was, you know, it was built up because, you know, the government prepared the, you know, public for us when we came here, you know, beforehand.
There was a lot of news coverage.
It was a lot of news coverage, you know, up to it, and it was probably explained that, you know, the government is doing the, you know, humanitarian evacuation and we're bringing these people here and stuff. So it was, we had very good, you know, positive press. And people were just so generous, and I had, you know, really good, you know, impression. They gave us a really good impression of, you know, people of Britain in general and, you know, English people, because, you know, it wasn't the East Midlands, it was pretty very English rural, you know, countryside.
And where did you decide to stay then?
Well, so it was quite interesting because in 1990, I started university and my dad was sacked from work, so I had to stop. Then I worked and opened my own business with my brother, and we established ourselves quite well. And in 1995, I went back to university again. And I just managed in 1998 to complete, you know, economics degree. And then I came here, and I was looking for jobs because I thought, well, I can communicate. Okay. And I wanted to apply for jobs, but nobody recognised my qualifications. So I had to do some, you know, additional courses. And then I applied for Derby University, a business course, 2 years course, via UCAS, you know, probably, and I got a place, and I wanted to study, and, you know, just study and get a bit more knowledge on business and all that, and go back home and be able to rebuild, you know, the country. Then, after 10 months being here, I got a job with Refugee Action. And then it was temporary, just 4 months job, and I was planning to finish my contract and just go and do studies. But then my status, you know, changed, my exceptional leave to remain expired, and I applied for extension. And I mean, I had a chance to apply to claim for asylum, to claim asylum, but I didn't because I had no grounds to claim asylum. So I applied for extension. I said, well, I'm studying here for 2 years. Can I have my status extended, and then I'll go back home? And then I was refused. And then I appealed against that refusal, and then I was refused. Well, I was refused again. I went to court and I had my hearing and all that, and I was refused. And then I applied for the right to appeal to the High, you know, Court, and I was refused the right to appeal. But then I was working in the meantime, so I applied for working visa. You know, the agency applied for me for working visa, and I got the working visa for 4 months. And then after 4 months, I applied again for another extension, and I got another extension for 2.5 years, whilst I had, you know, contract with Refugee Action. And then I couldn't go to university at the time, you know, to Derby University, because I'd lost my, you know, my status, and then I was afraid that if I lose my job, I would not be entitled to benefits, and I wouldn't be able to survive or, you know, fail myself. So I got another job, and then I moved to Bristol in 2000, and then I started work, so I couldn't go to university. I didn't have, you know, status. I couldn't afford to pay overseas fees. So I moved to Bristol, got a job here, and then life just took over.
I met a woman who lived for 7 years now. We had a daughter together. She's still pregnant again. And yeah, so life just took over.
And you're still here.
And I'm still here. And after a while, I just decided that, you know, one whole life, you know, was taken away from me. So I was not doing really well. I was not doing what I wanted to do because I never wanted to do joinery. But then I got thrown into it. I'd done really well. I set it up my business. I had 5 people employed for me and myself and my brother, and we were doing really well. And the whole that part of life was taken away. And I just decided that I'm going to decide for my life, and I want to live whatever I want to live. So I, you know, one life was taken away, and I'm not going to give up this one. And I just decided to, you know, fight and stay. And, you know, the life just took over, to be honest. Now I'm working, and I've got my status sorted, because working with a work permit for 4 years, you are entitled to apply for indefinite leave to remain. Then after 4 years, I applied for indefinite leave to remain. Then after a year, I applied for British citizenship, and now I've got British citizenship for about a year and a half now.
And have you taken
and
the test? And
I've taken
all
that
the stuff?
Test and the ceremony and all that stuff. So it was fine. I had no problems with that. But yeah, so I'm still here.
And are you ever tempted to? Do you go back to Kosovo?
I go very often. Yeah, I go very often. And last time I've been to Kosovo was in February. I went there for Independence Day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just couldn't miss that one. I went there with my daughter actually. And it was really nice, not in terms of, you know, now we're independent and all that, but it was quite cathartic, you know, journey for me. It was just like going to pilgrimage, because I went there, it was pretty cold and horrible, but I went home and stuff like that, and on the day of, you know, celebration and, you know, independence declaration, you know, we were getting ready to go out, you know, with my brothers and my family and stuff like that. It just felt like, it didn't feel like the day we left at home, but, you know, we were just waiting the whole way for my younger brother to put his gel and put his clothes on and stuff. I mean, he's not that young, he's 24, but most of them are good when he goes out. So we were waiting there, and we left the home, and loads of, you know, friends and neighbours were leaving their houses, and we were walking, you know, as a group towards town. When we went on the main street, and loads of people were walking towards the, you know, the town. And it just felt the same. It felt just like the time when we had to leave the house and we were seeing people. But the difference was that everybody was happy and everybody was celebrating. Whilst the first time around, everybody was so scared and sad and we were just going towards death. So that journey really, you know, helped with all my nightmares and fears and demons and stuff like that. And I don't mind telling everybody. That, you know, it was so good to go there and just experience that.
Come full circle.
Yeah, come full circle, exactly. It just felt like now I've got a choice, you know. And, yeah, I've chosen to live in England, and that's what I'm going to do. And if I want to go back, I can. I've got a home to go. And now it feels like I've got a home here as well, to be honest with you. You know, having children and having, you know, the whole family feels more homely. But it took really 9 years before I felt, you know, completely integrated and settled, if you know what I mean.
And what would you? How would you describe yourself now, in terms of your identity?
Oh my God, yes. Well,
the killer question.
Well, being from Kosovo, I'm very, you know, proud of, you know, who I am. I am British, you know, I've got two completely, you know, very legitimate nationalities, because Britain accepts dual nationality as well as Kosovo. So I've got two nationalities, but I feel I'm very proud of my heritage and, you know, Kosovo identity. And yeah, so that's how I feel.
So you can be both at the same time?
Well, I think I've integrated really well in the British society, and just about started to feel, you know, quite I belong here, and I'm, you know, belong here, but I still, you know, belong there as well. Because when I go home, I just honestly, I just go straight into, you know, their life, and